Work freelance, choose my own hours. Pinky. Replaces hands in pockets. So, thank you for the job offer, but I prefer to do freelance work. I try to focus on the words he is saying, rather than the accent, but it's difficult. You mean you choose to live in your van? And other people choose it? Sure. Look on Instagram under the hashtag vanlife. A lot of people my age are doing it. I frown at him. Wally looks to be about my age, perhaps a few years older. It feels astonishing that a person of around 30 years old, a computer programmer, would choose such an unorthodox way to live. Well, what kind of van is it? A combi. I have a bed, a kitchenette, a table where I can sit and eat. I use public facilities for showers, like here at the library. I use the laundromat for laundry, and I have pump water to clean my dishes. It's really not as difficult as people think. I am still dubious. Where do you keep it? Right now it's in the parking lot outside. At night I park it at the Uniting Church on Wilson Street. They let people park there all night. During the day I try to find all-day parking, or I move it every 2 hours. Sounds tedious. It's a lifestyle choice, Wally corrects. Okay. I nod, making my eyes wide to indicate that I have not been convinced. Well, I'm afraid I can't be of any help here. Unless you are looking for a book recommendation? My mood is immediately buoyed. What do you like to read, Wally? He frowns. Oh, no thanks. No thanks? I don't really read. I blink. You don't really read? I'm aware, of course, that there are people who don't read. There are those who insist they are far too busy to read and who instead spend their time watching Netflix and scrolling social media on their iPhones or Androids. Those who say they read so much for work that they couldn't possibly come home and read anymore. Those who cannot read. But judging from the document on the screen, Wally can read. Hence my confusion. Do you know how to read? Wally looks affronted. I have an IQ of 141. I used to read when I was a child, he says, almost thoughtfully now. I stopped at some point, I guess. What were your favorite books when you were a child? He appears to think about this. Let's see, well, I enjoyed The Outsiders, The Chocolate War, To Kill a Mockingbird. I have the perfect book, I say, cutting him off and heading toward general fiction, where I snatch up a copy of Jasper Jones. This will reignite your love of reading, I say upon my return. It's won several major awards and been shortlisted for half a dozen others, and it was made into a film in 2017. I place the book on top of his notebook, which is next to his laptop. And if you need me to set you up with a library card, I'd be happy to do that. He regards me for a longer than normal moment. Then something softens around his eyes. I apologize. I didn't catch your name. Fern Castle. I'm Rocco. He extends his hand as if to shake mine. I cross my arms in front of my chest. Oh, I prefer not to touch people if I can possibly help it. Did you know that we carry an average of 3,200 bacteria from 150 species on our hands at any one time? This includes fecal bacteria. If I shook hands with everyone I met at the library, I'd be constantly ill, not to mention contaminated with God knows what. I reach for my travel-sized antibacterial spray, which is attached to my overalls by a handy carabiner, and pump it into my hands. Would you like some? Oh, no, it's okay. Okay, thanks, he says, and I administer a squirt to his palm. He rubs his palms together. So, shall we see if we can do something about this printer then? Carmel is in the children's section now, watching Linda making recommendations to a mother of four sons who look like they'd much rather be kicking a football than be in the library. Perfect candidates for Paul Jennings or Andy Griffiths or any book with fart in the title, if you ask me. As such, I know now is the time to make my exit. I'm preparing to tilt my head, frown into the distance, and declare that I can hear someone calling me when I have an epiphany. Wally is handsome, in an odd sort of way. If his IQ is to be believed, he has a few brain cells, which means there's only... How is your health, Wally? The softness in his eyes is replaced with suspicion. It's excellent. I jog every morning, 10 kilometers. I smile. For once, the library computer service has brought me some good fortune. He smiles back at me a little uncertainly, until I pose my next question. Would you like to go on a date with me? His smile falls away. Journal of Rose Ingrid Castle. My therapist told me I should keep writing while I'm away. Seeing Owen again is likely to bring up some big emotions, he said, about the marriage as well as my desire to have a baby, and it will be helpful if I get them down on paper. And since I've watched all the movies I care to on the plane, here goes. I'm terrified about this reunion. I want to believe it will go well, obviously. I fantasize about it going well. In my fantasies, Owen will be happy to see me. He will explain that the reason he hasn't kept in touch is because it is too painful to talk to me knowing I'm so far away. But just because I fantasize about it doesn't mean I expect it to happen. I'm not stupid. I've noticed Owen has been lukewarm about my visit. I've considered the possibility that he's invited me to London to end things for good. Maybe I'd even arrive to find him on the arm of a beautiful English rose with an upper-class accent. The funny thing is, if that is the case, part of me will be satisfied, because it's what I think I deserve. This, of course, links things back to Mum. Everything, if you dig down far enough, links back to Mum. She taught us early on that love was conditional. To earn it, we had to perform like we were in a concert. Smile, be cute, say something funny. Know exactly what she wanted you to do, and do exactly that. She loved it when people found Fern and me charming, because it reflected well on her. I remember being on an outing with Mum in the city when we were about 6 or 7. By this time, we had been granted a little public housing flat just outside of the city, and we'd often take day trips into the city so Mum could get away from our home, which she hated. This day, we were passing a busker playing the trumpet when Fern stopped and started to dance. Mum had been in a hurry, so she didn't notice and kept walking. I tugged Fern's hand to keep her walking, but she just grabbed both my hands and spun me around, giggling. "Hey, look at those little girls," someone said. "Aren't they adorable?" someone else commented. After just a minute or two, a crowd gathered around us, clapping and cheering. I'd never had dancing lessons. Neither of us had. But even then I knew there was something magical about Fern. Her golden hair, her long limbs, the pure joy in her eyes. She was like an angel. "Who do these girls belong to?" someone asked. People looked around expectantly. My stomach was already in knots. When Mum noticed we were missing, she'd be livid. "They're mine," came her voice. Fern and I whipped around to where Mum was standing, her hand raised. She beamed from ear to ear. "There you are, my little ballerinas, putting on a show as always." She laughed, throwing the crowd a little eye roll. "Don't get too mad with them, Mum," someone said. "They've got a big future in front of them." Mum accepted people's accolades, basking in the attention. Receiving compliments was one of only a few things that consistently made her happy. Even so, I couldn't relax completely. She might be smiling now, but I knew there'd be no applause for us when we got back home. If Fern shared my discomfort, she hid it well. Her shoulders were relaxed, her face was open. I remember being glad for her. Fern always seemed to have some sort of impenetrable boundary around her that made her immune to Mum's reign of terror. I often wondered if that boundary was part and parcel of whatever was so different about Fern. But Mum never took her for an official diagnosis. Giving Fern a diagnosis or help would have made her special, and Mum was the only one allowed to be special in our house. But even if Fern wasn't scared of Mum, that didn't mean Mum wasn't a danger to her. I remember one time when we were 7 when Fern drew on the coffee table. That had been a terrifying day. It wasn't an expensive table. It probably didn't cost anything at all. We got most of our furniture from the Salvation Army back then. We were still living in the council flat at the time, and Mum's welfare payments, she regularly told us, didn't stretch to fancy things. It had been an innocent mistake. There had been laundry all over the kitchen table, and Fern had asked Mum where she could do her homework. Mum had said, do it on the coffee table. It was impressive, really. Mum had been Fern's mother for 7 years and still hadn't figured out how she would interpret those words. If I had noticed, I would have redirected her myself. But by the time I saw it, it was too late. Who wrote on the coffee table? Mum roared when she'd seen it. She'd been in a bad mood all day, but now she was enraged. I would have taken the blame. I was just about to, in fact. But Fern raised her hand before I could. She'd been so carefree about it, so utterly unaware of impending danger. She'd even smiled a little. It was too late for me to tap my bracelet against hers to warn her. I held my breath. Mum could fly off the handle for the smallest thing. Talking too loudly, talking too quietly, not thanking her profusely enough. Who knew what she would do if we actually did something bad? I must have nudged myself ever so slightly in front of Fern, because I remember Mum narrowing her eyes, distracted from the coffee table for a second. What are you doing? She said, her voice changing. She sounded curious, but in a careful, cold way. Are you trying to protect her? She stared at me coldly. Took me a moment to realize my sin. By expressing love for Fern, by wanting to protect her, I'd betrayed Mum. Our purpose, after all, was to love her. I would never hurt Fern. Mum's voice was like ice. It's just a silly coffee table. What? Do you think I'm some kind of monster? No, Mum. Do monsters feed their children? No. Do they give up everything for their children? No. Dread pooled in my stomach as Mum got right up in my face. What about these clothes? She said, pulling at my t-shirt. Do monsters buy clothes for their children? It was the first time I thought Mum might hit me. She had never hit me before. It was a source of pride for her. I've never laid a hand on my kids, she would say to anyone who'd listen. The implication was that hitting your kids was something bad parents did, and she was not a bad mother. But that day her face was so contorted, so angry. Her breath was so hot in my face. I was bracing for it, almost welcoming it, when abruptly she turned and marched out of the room. Fern and I hurried after her. By the time we got to, her mum was already pulling things off the shelves. Books, toys, shoes. Do monsters buy their kids stuffed animals? She cried, tossing our toys across the room. Pens? What about plastic seaside buckets? Thunk, crash, bang. She got hold of our jewelry box, the one that played music with a little ballerina inside. Our dad had given it to us. Fern and I listened to it each night after lights out. Mum knew this, of course. That's why she looked so elated as she slammed it against the wall and cracked it down the middle. It went on until there was a mound of broken things in the middle of our bedroom. As Fern and I watched, I remember thinking that somehow what Mum was doing was worse than hitting, and how I wished she'd just hit me instead. Fern. When I was a kid, I loved school. There were several reasons for this, most notably the routine of going every day, the timetable, which ensured I always knew what to expect, the learning, the reading. There were many things about school I found troublesome, of course. The people, the noise, the lights, the smells. Still, I became adept at finding solutions. I tried to arrive at school after the bell had sounded, hence avoiding the morning rush. I sat in the front row, where chatter tended to be kept to a minimum. At lunchtime, I ate my sandwich outside and then went to the library to read. After school, I went the long way home, so I didn't need to make small talk with any of the kids. Generally, my workarounds worked well. But there was one day each year that I had no workarounds for. Swimming carnival. For a person with sensory processing issues, A swimming carnival is what hell would look like. The warm, wet claustrophobia of the building, the cheering and shouting, the garish team colours, the stench of chlorine. I'd composed several compelling arguments in order to persuade Mum to let me stay home, but Mum always declined. "You need to show team spirit, Fern," she'd say. "It's important to support your peers." The first year, I'd steeled myself. I wasn't required to participate, at least, one upside of attending a school with no mandatory sport. All that was required was that I stand on the side and cheer. I came prepared with earplugs, but it was the smell that did me in. It was something else. It wasn't the mild fragrance of salt water and chlorine like I'd smelled in backyard swimming pools. It was warm and wet, stale and dank. The moment I walked inside, I felt it permeate every pore. It felt like being underwater, but without the wonderful silence. To the contrary, it was the worst kind of loud. Inside loud. Rose had taken my hand as we walked inside, which I knew was supposed to be a gesture of comfort, but it made my skin crawl. It felt like yet another thing coating me, begging for my attention. She led us to the top of the stadium, the second row from the back, and sat me on the floor. From there, with everyone standing in front, the teachers couldn't see us and no one could pester us to cheer. It wasn't ideal, but it was the best I could hope for. I felt like I was drowning. The chlorine stuck to my skin, the back of my school dress, my feet. I tolerated it, just, until Rose went to do her races. Rose, for some unimaginable reason, had signed up for the 50-meter freestyle and the relay. "Just keep your head down," Rose had said before she left. "I'll be back as soon as I can." I passed the time by counting backward from a million in nines. But the time dragged on and on. Just when I thought I couldn't take it another second, Mr. McIntosh noticed me on the floor and shouted for me to stand up. Mr. McIntosh was the science teacher. He had yellow teeth and smelled of onions and breath mints. At the same time as he pointed, my team must have won something because an almighty victorious roar erupted in the stadium. In the row in front of me, a boy I didn't recognize with long white blonde hair picked me up and spun me around, jumping up and down and shouting, "Yes!" My senses exploded. It was as though I'd slipped into another dimension. I didn't mean to hurt him. It must have been a reflex. A well-executed reflex that started with an eye gouge and followed with a knee smash to the groin. I was starting to calm down when someone touched me from behind. A reverse elbow strike later, Mr. McIntosh had a broken nose. During the follow-up meeting, our school principal, Ms. Knight, commented that the greatest concern is the fact that she hasn't even shown any remorse. I told her that, to the contrary, all I felt was relief, because it could have been so much worse. I knew that in that moment, I could have killed someone. I arrive at the Botanic Gardens at 11:45, 15 minutes before my scheduled date with Wally. I'd planned to use the extra time to secure a spot in the shade, lay out the blanket I'd brought from home, and unpack the sandwiches. I packed honey for myself, as usual, and one honey and one Vegemite for Wally in case he doesn't care for honey. But as I enter through the east gate, I am alarmed to find that Wally is already here, sitting on a blanket in the shade of a tree, his long legs stretched out in front of him. "You're early," I exclaim. "I always try to arrive a quarter of an hour early if I can." "Really?" I say in wonderment. "So do I." "Who doesn't value punctuality?" he says, shrugging. "A lot of people, actually," I say. "I think you'd be surprised." I arrange myself comfortably on the blanket, which is adequately sized for the two of us, and not at all scratchy, which is often the case with picnic blankets. Our date had been fairly straightforward to organize, once I'd explained to Wally what a date was. "You're asking me on a date?" he said after I'd asked him. It was a surprise, since he'd clearly heard, and I couldn't see how he would need any further clarification. "Yes," I said, as slowly and clearly as I could. Still, he looked bewildered. So much so that for the barest second he looked me directly in the eyes. Date? At this point, I was starting to doubt his professed IQ. Wally was silent for long enough that I started wondering if he'd had a medical episode. Had I made a social faux pas? The brief research I'd done on the computers had confirmed that girls did this sort of thing nowadays, asked boys on dates, and yet the poor boy seemed utterly perplexed. It occurred to me that it might be the word date throwing him off. According to Urban Dictionary, a date is where two people get together for an activity when the possibility of romance between them has been broached but not ruled out, I explained. Wally's face remained blank. I sighed. This was the exact reason I favored planning over spontaneity. Normally, when I did something outside of the ordinary, like competing in a karate tournament or attending a librarian's convention at the state library, I spent a lot of time planning for it. Familiarizing myself with the best route to take, checking the train timetable, making sure the medical provider was running on time. But this day, it seemed, I'd gone off half-cocked. I decided to offer Wally one further explanation I'd sourced from Urban Dictionary before giving up. An activity between two mutually attracted people which very often ends in one or both leaving sexually frustrated. Finally, bizarrely, he laughed. A funny half-laugh that seemed like he wasn't sure if he was laughing or clearing his throat. Then he threw up his hands and said, "You know what? Sure. I'm free Saturday." "Me too, after karate." He nods. "What would you like to do?" I realized a picnic was the only real option for our date, considering I don't go to restaurants or shopping malls and the movies can be troubling if the sound is too loud or the smell of popcorn too strong. Wally agreed to the picnic, and then, as if the heavens had been smiling upon us, a ridiculous expression as heaven surely doesn't have a face, let alone a mouth to smile with, the printer burst into life and started working, and I was able to excuse myself and dash away before anyone else could ask for assistance. Now, here we are, 15 minutes early. I notice Wally is wearing the same black-framed glasses and buffalo flannelette button-down shirt with jeans, and of course that same ridiculous hat. I have to admit, I find the sameness of him soothing. It's always been unsettling to me the way people change their appearance. Linda from the library, for example, changes her hair with frightening frequency. Not just the color, but the style. Some days straight, other days curled, other days scraped back to her scalp and glistening as if wet. Linda, of course, is an extreme example, but most people tend to change at the very least their clothes on a daily basis. A new pair of earrings or a brighter lipstick than normal. A change is as good as a holiday, the saying goes, but I've never found change or holidays appealing. For this reason, I am wearing my favorite sun yellow skirt and rainbow t-shirt with comfortable sneakers. My only discomfort is that my lips feel tacky because this morning, after reading online that one should put effort into one's appearance for a date, I'd applied lip gloss. I dearly love to remove it, but find myself without anything in the way of a tissue or napkin. "What is it?" Wally says.
"What is what?"
"You're staring at me."
"Am I?"
I consider this a moment. Then I wonder how he even knows this, since his gaze appears to be over my left shoulder as usual. "Staring competition?" I venture. It seems as good an icebreaker as any. But after a promising start where Wally's eyes widen slightly, he just gazes back over my shoulder. I wonder if he has an issue with his eyes.
"Beat you," I exclaim.
His expression morphs into that funny smile frown.
"You're no good at staring competitions," I remark, pulling my sandwiches out of my tote.
As I offer Wally the sandwich I brought for him, he opens his own bag and pulls out an impressive haul, an artisan loaf, a wheel of brie, a bag of grapes, even a block of dark chocolate.
"My goodness!"
"What?"
"You've brought a veritable feast. Where did you get all of this?"
"All this?" he says, gesturing to the food. "I stole it." My mouth opens.
"You stole it?"
He snorts. "Of course I didn't steal it. What kind of person do you think I am? I got it from the supermarket." I am skeptical. "Why did you spend so much money when you can't even afford to live in a flat or a house?"
"It's not that I can't afford a house. I live in my van as a... A lifestyle choice? Yes. Uh-huh. I unwrap my sandwich. I feel his eyes and find him watching me with a dull smile. Well, you may not believe it, but I enjoy the simplicity of the van. But I do have enough money for food. I'm a freelance computer programmer, remember? He retrieves a bread knife from his bag and begins slicing the loaf of bread, chuckling. Why do you freelance? Surely you could get a permanent job as a computer programmer. I could. He keeps slicing. But you don't want to? He puts down the knife. No. Another lifestyle choice? He grins. Exactly. It's an odd choice, but I find myself admiring him for it. I've often thought about the way people blindly fall into the footprints of their forefathers, getting jobs, buying homes, working hard, and then dying. Well, I say, that's very courageous of you, Wooly. Thank you, he says, though my name is Rocco. You don't look like a Rocco. He gives another snort. And yet that's exactly what I am. Wooly arranges an elaborate-looking sandwich of cheese, sliced ham, and tomato while I tuck into my honey on white. The date is going quite well so far, I think. We've made conversation. We're consuming a meal. According to my research, that's pretty much all there is to it. I've dismissed the possibility of getting pregnant today, obviously. Apart from the fact that it would be awkward and quite possibly illegal to have sexual intercourse in a park, I'm not ovulating. I know this because I bought some ovulation testing kits at the pharmacist, which tell me, by virtue of a smiley face and a small window, when ovulation is imminent. The booklet suggested testing around day 10 of your cycle, with a view to ovulation occurring around day 14, which according to my calculations means I'll need a second date in just under a week to execute that part of the plan. So, tell me about van living, I say, swallowing a mouthful of sandwich. I'd pre-prepared the question. Asking questions is a tactic I use when small talk is required. It makes you appear interested while simultaneously putting all the effort of the conversation on the other party. What do you like about it? Wally is lying on the blanket, resting on one elbow. Many things, he says. I find the small space cozy, like sleeping in a little cocoon. When it rains, I hear it pelting the roof. When it's windy, I feel the wind up against the car. It's like I'm out in it, but protected. What else? I like that I can't have too many possessions, so when I do buy something, I have to consider whether I really need it. It means I only end up with things that are incredibly useful or very precious. I like that I'm not imprisoned by anything. Debt, weather, bad neighbors. My home is wherever I am. Where is the van now? Down the road. There's a 4-hour parking spot about a mile from here. Don't you find it unsettling having to move about all the time like that? A little, he admits. But moving around is kind of cool. I consider this. I moved around a lot when I was a child. Not in a van, though. I can't say I found it cool. Wooly shifts on his elbow, getting comfortable. Why did you move a lot? Folks in the army? I shake my head. Honestly, I'm not sure. I would have preferred more permanence, but things always came up. Mum lost her job or the landlord needed us to move. Wooly is really paying attention to me, which is both awkward and quite nice. Perhaps this is why, on a whim, I add, my mum wasn't the greatest mum, I guess. It feels like a betrayal for some reason. I don't like speaking badly of mum. It feels wrong somehow. Rose doesn't feel bad about it. She and mum never got along, even when we were kids. I remember hiding in the closet with Rose when we were 10, after mum and Rose had argued about something. Fern, I know you don't understand this, Rose had said. But mum isn't a good mum. You have to do what I say, okay? Otherwise I can't protect you. She isn't a good mum, okay? Okay, I'd said. I'm sorry, Wooly says. She overdosed when I was 12, and my sister and I were put into foster care. Wooly sits up. Wow, Fern, that's awful. I focus on the remains of the food, the grapes lolling on the chopping board. I was lucky I had Rose. She's my twin sister. I half expect Wooly to have a reaction to this. Inexplicably, people seem to have such curious reactions when I report that I am a twin. In social gatherings, often all I have to do is mention that I'm a twin, and the rest of the conversation is consumed by the twins in that person's family, whether they were naturally or artificially conceived, or how their great aunt Margaret was a twin but her brother died in childbirth. I enjoy this because all I have to do is nod and smile, which is infinitely easier than having to say anything myself. But, extraordinarily, Wally appears to be one of the few people on Earth who doesn't have anything to contribute to the twin conversation. "Rose is my person," I tell him. Wally blinks.
"Your person?"
"You know, your person. Your wife or husband, your child, your boyfriend, your best friend. Someone whose name you can put down on paperwork. Someone you can share personal information with. Someone you can rely on." Wally unscrews the lid off a bottle of water and takes a sip.
"Interesting," he says.
Conversation starts to dwindle then, so I decide it is time to proceed to the next part of the date. Astonishingly, I know what this should entail. Last night, in preparation, I'd undertaken a rom-com marathon, watching specifically for tips on the running order of a date. Trying to be scientific, I'd taken copious notes and upon comparing them found they had a lot in common. The first stage of each date was either a little dull or an unequivocal disaster, where the person arrived late or dressed in entirely inappropriate clothing. The next stage involved each party sharing something personal. The final stage invariably involved a wacky incident such as a bird coming to eat the couple's food or someone spilling a drink all over the other, forcing all parties to escape amid a cloud of hilarity which inevitably turned into a romance later in the show. As such, I determined that the wacky incident is the most crucial of the three stages. I glance around for a potential wacky incident, and finding none, I open my water bottle and pour its contents over our remaining food. At a loss for what to do next, I throw back my head and laugh loudly. Wally's eyes boggle.
"What the? Fern, are you all right?"
His enunciation is made particularly perfect by his bewilderment. My laughter dies down to an uncertain giggle.
"I don't know." "You might be the strangest person I've ever met, you know that?"
Wally says, shaking his head. And just as I am thinking things aren't going to plan, he laughs.
"I can't believe I'm saying this, but I like it."
An hour later, as Wally and I pack up the picnic, I feel irritable. I'm trying to figure out the reason why, since the date, at least when compared with some of the disastrous dates from my rom-com marathon, has been an unequivocal success, when I notice Wally waving his hands in front of my face.
"What are you doing?"
I ask. He holds up my phone.
"Your phone. It's ringing."
"Oh!" That explains why I was feeling irritable. The sound of a phone ringing is among the most crazy-making noises in the world for me. The tinny, repetitive sound of it, the accompanying vibration. Thankfully, my phone rarely rings. Rose sends text messages unless it's an emergency, and if anyone else calls, I let it go to voicemail. But when I look at the screen and see it's Rose calling, I feel my heart rate increase. She's calling. It must be an emergency. I press the phone to my ear. "What is it, Rose?"
"Oh, good, you're there. I hope it didn't scare you, me calling like this, but I have just heard from the neighbour and she said Alfie has been barking a lot."
I scan my brain for a reason why Rose might be calling from Europe to tell me this.
"Was he okay this morning when you fed him?"
I start to get a bad feeling.
"I didn't feed him this morning." "You didn't?" Rose says. "Why not?"
"Why not?" I repeat, trying to make sense of the question, but I can't.
"Fern," Rose says, "tell me you have been feeding and walking Alfie."
I don't understand," I say. "Why do you want me to tell you that?" There is a long silence, followed by a long, low expletive. I wait, suddenly feeling quite ill.
"Fern, I told you I would put him in a kennel."
Rose has her breathless, flustered voice on, the one she uses when talking to people about packages not arriving or being overcharged for the electricity bill.
She hardly ever uses this voice with me. You insisted. You said you would feed Alfie.
I have no recollection of this, but if Rose says I did, then I did. I take a moment to consider the ramifications of this. It's been 4 days since Rose went away. 4 days since Alfie has been without food or walks. I search my brain for information on how long dogs can survive without food, but I don't know. I think I might be sick. Rose is clicking her tongue in that way she does when she is panicking.
What are we going to do? She says.
I look at Wally, who is watching me intently. You said your van is down the road? He nods. Rose, I say into the phone. I'm on my way to your house. Wally is very efficient with time management, as it turns out. After I explain what has happened, he offers to run and get his van, and he does indeed run, while I pack up the picnic. By the time I shove everything into the bags and get to the gate, Wally is waiting for me in an orange, vintage-looking combi van. He opens the passenger door from the inside. Where to? He asks, and I direct him to Rose's house, a 15-minute drive from the Botanic Gardens. He leaves the radio off as we drive and does me the favor of not talking, which I appreciate as I need to keep my brain space clear to focus on Alfie. Not that I can think much. I feel wobbly with the anxiety of it all. I wrap my arms around myself, trying to keep myself calm. I will be of no use to Alfie unless I can stay calm. When we pull up outside Rose and Owen's house, it looks the same as always. Someone must be collecting the mail, because there isn't any sticking out of the letterbox. I wonder why Rose didn't ask whoever was collecting the post to feed and walk the dog too. If she had, maybe Alfie would be all right. Wally gets out of the car first. Where will he be? In the backyard, I say. Wally races up the side of the house and flings open the gate, while I walk more slowly behind him, arms still wrapped around myself. When I get to the backyard, I see Alfie is lying on his dog bed on the back veranda. He's utterly still. I try to take a step toward him, but find myself frozen on the spot. He's so still, unmoving. I see him. I feel his skin and hair in my grasp. Wet, dead flesh. I've done it again. Wally kneels at Alfie's side. He's alive. It's all right, Fern, he's alive. I nod, but relief is slow to come. Alfie's alive. Not everyone has been as lucky. His water bowl's dry, Wally continues. Where can I find the hose? I don't reply. Wally looks around and finds it himself. We need to take him to the vet, Wally says to me, filling the bowl. When I don't reply, he says, Fern, I need you to listen to me, okay? This appears to be a circuit breaker, and I snap to attention. Yes, okay, the vet. Wally places the filled water bowl in front of Alfie. When he doesn't drink, Wally cups water in his hands and holds it to Alfie's snout. After he's had a drink, he picks up Alfie as if he were a newborn baby. Fern, Wally says, can you get the car door? I do. Once I'm strapped into the passenger seat, Wally passes Alfie to me, positioning him so Alfie's head is supported by my elbow. The whole process means that Wally is required to touch me several times, and while I am aware of it, I don't recoil. The vet has thick grey eyebrows. I am staring at them as he tells us Alfie is lucky. He's dehydrated, apparently. Alfie, not the vet. But he has been rehydrated on intravenous fluids for hours, and he's doing much better now. In fact, most of the vet's concerns are about how the mix-up happened in the first place. He tells us that in these sorts of cases, he usually calls the RSPCA, who then check to ensure the dog is in an adequate home, but Wally manages to convince him that Alfie will be fine in our care. He is impressively convincing. By the time he is finished, even I almost believe him. I assure you, he says, it was all a misunderstanding. Alfie could not be in better hands. I look at my hands. When I look up again, The vet is looking at me. Do you work, Ms. Castle?
Yes, I say. I'm a librarian.
So you're out of the house most of the day?
Yes, but, I say.
I'll be with Alfie when she's at work, Wally cuts in. I'm the dog sitter. Alfie won't be alone for a moment.
I look at Wally in surprise. He studiously avoids my gaze. The vet looks from me to Wally and back again. Finally, he exhales.
He'll need to be given small sips of water every hour for the next few days. I'll also give you some electrolyte powder. If he isn't keeping anything down, give him ice cubes to lick. I'd like you both to bring the dog back in a couple of days so I can see for myself that he's being taken care of. Okay?
Okay, Wally and I say in unison.
Make an appointment at the front desk. 2 days.
We both nod, and a few minutes later, reluctantly, the vet releases Alfie into our care. On the way home, we stop at Rose's to pick up Alfie's food, lead, and water bowl. Then I call Rose. It goes better than I expect. Rose is calmer once she knows Alfie is all right. She apologizes for being frustrated and says she blames herself. She should have checked Alfie into the kennel like she planned. I tell her that I'm taking Alfie back to my flat and will keep him there for the rest of the time Rose is away. I'm not sure why I didn't suggest that when Rose asked me. I wish I could remember. How is Owen? I ask.
He's great. He says to say hello.
Tell him I say hello back.
I will.
So, you're having a good time?
A perfect time. Just wonderful. I'm missing you, though.
I miss you, too. I wrap up the phone call quickly, partly because I expect that Rose will be busy with Owen, and partly because it feels like it might be rude to chat while Wally is sitting right here in the car. When I hang up, though, I'm still feeling heartsick about the whole thing. It could have been so much worse. Just another few hours, and...
Stop thinking about it, Wally says.
I can't.
The important thing is that Alfie is okay, right?
For now, I say.
For now?
Wally laughs.
Are you planning on hurting him?
You don't always have to plan it, I think. I don't remember Rose asking me. It doesn't even ring a bell. That's what scares me the most.
Well, Wally says, maybe she forgot to ask. She was preparing for an overseas trip. She probably had a million things on her mind. It probably slipped her mind.
I shake my head. Rose doesn't forget things.
Do you forget things? Wally asks.
Yes, with great regularity.
That surprises me.
It surprises me too, I think. All the time. It can be distressing at times, I admit. Always worrying about what I might have forgotten, or what I might do wrong if left to my own devices. This is more emotional than my typical conversation, and I don't feel entirely comfortable with it. I wonder if it is a side effect of being on a date.
What makes you think you'd do anything wrong? Wally asks.
Past experience, I say, as we turn into my street. I point to my block. This is my place here. Wally parks in front. He pulls up the handbrake, and then pushes his glasses back up his nose. Something that is fast becoming a trademark of his.
How do you live your life with that fear?
There's no good answer for this. I just do. What choice do I have?
Wow, he says. That's brave.
I don't know what to say to that. It feels like a good time to change the subject. Did you mean it when you said you would watch Alfie for me while I'm at work? I ask.
I don't say things I don't mean.
Well, I say, in that case, see you Monday morning? 9 a.m. Wally agrees, and I slide out of the car, Alfie in my arms. As I watch him drive away, I realize I feel something akin to content. It makes me worry for a world where someone like me can feel content after what I did. I fall asleep quickly, but I wake each hour to check on Alfie. I set an alarm for this, but each time I wake a few minutes before the alarm, instantly oriented. There is no buffering period, no momentary confusion. I know where I am. I know it was a dream, even if I can still feel the cool, wet flesh beneath my hands, the kicking and writhing, my fingers gripping so tightly that they tremble. I also know it wasn't just a dream. It was a memory, a warning,
Most of all, it's a reminder. Don't get ahead of yourself, Fern. Remember what you're capable of. As if I could forget. I glance at the alarm clock. 3:43 a.m. Time to check on Alfie again and offer him some water. 3 more weeks without Rose. Will I survive it? Journal of Rose Ingrid Castle. It's like I woke up in a dream. Owen met me at the airport with open arms and a bunch of peonies. You know how couples often have a song? Well, we have a flower, and it is peonies. He gave me a bunch on our first date, and I carried them in my wedding bouquet. Over the years, 4 years this spring, whenever there has been a special occasion, a promotion, a birthday, an anniversary, it was always celebrated with peonies. After dropping my bags at his Fulham apartment, we went straight to dinner, a really fancy place in Chelsea. When we got back to his place afterward, I checked the medicine cabinet and the sheets in the laundry for scents of perfume. Clear on both counts. It feels too good to be true. Owen said all the things I had hoped for. That he missed me, that he had been miserable without me, that he wanted to try us again. We made love the first night, and the next morning, and the night after that. The sex was better in London. We both agreed. Something about the Northern Hemisphere. Everything was perfect. Except for the Fern situation. I blame myself. I should never have left her in charge of Alfie. If I'd been thinking clearly, I would have tried to keep things as simple as possible for her. Nothing that strayed from her routine. But Fern could seem so high-functioning that even I could be lulled into a false sense of security. Still, even with the Fern situation, it's hard to be too upset when things with Owen are going so well. I try not to think about the fact that soon I'll have to go home. Leaving has always been a trigger for me. Because, you guessed it, Mum. From around the time we were 8, leaving was always her threat. It might have been in response to something we said or did, like being ill or being stressed about a test at school. Not that we ever admitted to either. We'd learned by then that we weren't allowed to have troubles of our own. Sometimes, it was for no reason at all. "Looking a bit glum today," Mum would say. "If everything is so bad, maybe I should just leave. I'm obviously making your life terrible." I knew I shouldn't, but every time she threatened to leave, I cried. Real throat-clogging tears, the kind that came from the depths of my soul. A couple of times I cried so hard I vomited. Make no bones about it, I was terrified of Mum. I dreamed of her being kinder, more loving, more like other mothers. But I never, not even once, dreamed of her leaving. "What are you crying about?" she'd snap. "I thought you'd be thrilled to have me gone." She'd act like she was frustrated, but I think she liked it when I cried. The tears validated her, made her feel worthy. When, after the drama, Mum would agree to stay, I would count it as a victory. I assumed it was my devotion to her that was keeping her around. But the older we got, the more volatile she became. It didn't take long before Mum's moods began to dictate my day, and it didn't matter what she was feeling. Whatever it was, I was terrified. If she was happy, I was terrified I would ruin it. If she was unhappy, I was terrified she'd blame me. If she wasn't around, I was terrified that she had left for good. Any other mood, and I was terrified she was dreaming up some new way to be cruel. One of her favourite things was to mock me about food. "Back in the kitchen, Rosie Round?" she'd say whenever possible, a playful look in her eyes. "You know what they say, a minute on the lips, a lifetime on the hips." If I had the audacity to look even slightly upset by these comments, she'd say I was being too sensitive, which in Mum's eyes was an unforgivable thing to be. It was before I was diagnosed with diabetes, and I was constantly hungry and thirsty. I tried not to eat too much, and I certainly didn't want to do anything to invite Mum's criticism, but I couldn't help it. Inevitably, I would end up right back in the kitchen. It didn't matter that Fern ate as much as I did. Mum never said a word to her. Once I asked her why she never said anything to Fern, and she shrugged as if it was obvious. "Because Fern can afford to eat what she wants. She has my metabolism." She was right. Fern was a clone of Mum physically.
They were both tall and the kind of skinny where a stray elbow could puncture flesh. Fern also had Mum's hair, a crowning glory of tumbling, honey-coloured waves. It felt unfair to be twins with her. Next to Fern, I felt like a frumpy interloper, even before Mum decided to point it out. On our 9th birthday, there was another blow-up, this time over a cake Mum made us from the Women's Weekly cookbook. Mum made us a fancy cake every year, yet another of the contradictions that was our mother. It was a source of great pride for her. She loved anything that made her feel like a good mother. It was always a big production, selecting the cake she wanted to make, shopping for the ingredients, looking for tips and tricks. That year, she decided it was going to be a unicorn cake, the most difficult she'd attempted. In the lead-up, she'd been to 3 different shops to find the right cake tin, and yet another to get the icing and the gold edible horn. It was a nice time for all of us, not because Fern and I cared much about the cake, but because Mum's mood was always buoyed by the cake making. As usual, we weren't allowed in the kitchen while she made the cake. We were only invited in for the exciting reveal when it was done. The unveiling was Mum's favourite part. We were required to squeal with joy, thank her profusely, and ask a million questions about how she did it. Even Fern seemed to understand how we were to act. On this birthday, we performed our roles with aplomb, and Mum seemed very pleased, which in turn meant I felt torn between being happy and being terrified that something would happen to mess it up. After we sang Happy Birthday, Mum took a photo of Fern and me in front of the cake before I was dispatched to get plates. Peering into the cupboard, I agonized over whether to use the good plates or the plastic for so long I was sure Mum would snap at me, asking what the heck I was doing. When I finally produced the good plates, she merely nodded her approval. The relief was so great, I went weak with it. It almost went off without a hitch. Almost. But when I reached for my piece of cake, I felt Mum's cold finger poking me in the stomach. "Not too much now, Rosie Round," she said with a snigger. It might have been the fact that my nerves had been stretched taut all day. It might have been that it had been so close to being a good day. It might have been that it was a hard poke and Mum's nails were sharp. The tears came in a flood. "Oh, for God's sake, it was just a joke. Why can't you take a joke, Rose?" I willed myself to get it together, but the tears showed no sign of abating. I tried looking at the roof, dabbing at my eyes, even smiling through tears, but nothing worked. This just annoyed Mum more. "So I'm a bad mother now, am I? After I've spent weeks planning this cake for you? Perfect." "No," I said, at the same time as a sob escaped. Fern, who'd been obliviously tucking into her piece of cake, paused, her fork halfway to her mouth. I stood beside her, tapping my bracelet gently against hers. She knew this was a warning. "Something is coming." It was the best I could do. Mum flung up her arms. "And now you've ruined Fern's birthday too. Great work, Rose, really great work." Mum stormed off, leaving Fern and me alone. 5 minutes later, when we heard a noise, we crept into the hallway to find Mum was dragging a suitcase toward the door. "Where are you going?" I cried. "What's it to you?" Mum hissed. "You clearly don't want me around, even with everything I do for you. You'll be fine without me." Instantly, I was shaking. "No, we do want you around. We need you. Don't go, Mummy, please." She locked the door behind her. I banged at it, screamed for her to come back, pressed my ear against the door to listen for movement. When it became clear she wasn't coming back, I sat in the hallway. Fern sat beside me, silent but serious. I quickly figured out that we couldn't call the police. If we did that and Mum returned, she'd be furious. We couldn't go to the neighbours for the same reason. And besides, Mum didn't like us talking to strangers. We couldn't do anything. We just had to wait. After a couple of hours, I went to the kitchen and checked the cupboards, determining that we had enough food to last us a week or so if we cooked the pasta and rice and defrosted the frozen food. If Mum wasn't back by then, I'd have to make a new plan. I kept making plans well into the night, long after Fern was asleep, her head lolling against my shoulder.
Eventually, I must have fallen asleep too, because when I woke up, it was light outside. Fern was sprawled on the floor beside me, and Mum was there, standing over me. It took me a few seconds to put everything back together, what happened, where we were, what day it was. When I realized she was back, I flew into her arms so fast I nearly knocked her over. Of course, I burst into a fresh flood of tears, but this time, when I cried, it didn't seem to upset Mum. To the contrary, she fell to her knees and held me, rubbing my back in rhythmic circles. "Shh, Mummy's here now," she said. "Shh, everything is going to be all right." Fern. When I took Alfie back to the vet yesterday, the vet had stressed the importance of making sure Alfie wasn't left alone. This had made me feel better about the fact that I'd arranged for Wally to look after him today. I help a woman wanting a book recommendation for her introverted 12-year-old daughter who wants to become a writer. I give her a copy of I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith. I set up chairs for a Toastmasters group in the function room, and I ask a man who has been in the bathroom for over an hour if he requires any assistance. It turns out he dropped his wedding ring down the sink, and Tom, the maintenance man, has to search for it in the S-bend. I fold and restack the newspapers and lie on the floor to read a book to a little boy who doesn't want to sit on a chair in the kids' area. So, more or less a regular day at the library. When Wally arrived outside my building in his orange combi van, I will admit to being relieved to see him. Yes, we'd made an arrangement, but people can be fickle with arrangements. Sometimes, for no apparent reason, plans can be cancelled, postponed, or even just deemed to be an idea rather than an actual plan, as is often the case when coffee is involved, I've found. "Let's have coffee," people will say, but then seem perplexed when I get out my diary to determine when we will drink it. So I was pleasantly surprised when Wally showed up. I was all ready for him, naturally. I had packed up Alfie's lead, his food, his water bowl, and two large bottles of tap water so Wally could fill it up even if he couldn't find a tap or hose. I'd also given Wally a wad of plastic bags for dog poo and a tennis ball. Wally took it all eagerly, which was quite nice. I'd always found there was something agreeable about people who liked dogs and something untrustworthy about those who didn't. The night before, I'd considered telling Rose that I was outsourcing Alfie's care for the day, but after careful consideration, I decided against it. After what had already happened with Alfie, I wanted to spare her the additional worry of a stranger looking after her dog, even if, judging by the text messages Wally has been sending from the dog park, Alfie is receiving a vastly superior level of attention than he would receive in either Rose's or my care. Mid-morning, I'm looking at one such text message, a photo message of Alfie sitting on Wally's lap at a cafe drinking from a bowl shaped as a coffee mug labelled Puppy Chino, when I am intercepted by Carmel and her cart. "Fern, I'm glad I ran into you," Carmel says, even though she was not running and nor had we made physical contact. She is wearing a bold yellow dress that suits neither her skin tone nor her personality. "I notice you haven't put your name down for the staff bowling day." She pauses expectantly, as if waiting for an answer, even though no matter how many times I replay her comment, I can't find the question. Once, years ago, Rose told me that conversations were simply a series of questions. One person asked a question, the other person answered, and it went back and forth like this until the questions ran out. This explanation has assisted me through countless episodes of small talk, but lately it feels like more and more people are opting for statement-to-statement types of conversation, which generally leaves me at a loss. I am still searching for an appropriate response when Carmel continues. "Cat got your tongue?" The expression isn't as ridiculous as it sounds. I googled it several years back and established there were two possible origins. One, referencing a whip used by the Royal Navy called the Cat-o'-nine-tails. Apparently the pain this whip inflicted was so severe that it caused the victim to stay quiet for a long time. Or two, derived from ancient Egypt where liars and blasphemers' tongues were cut out and fed to the cats. "I am able to speak," I confirm, "and you are correct that I haven't put my name on the list for the bowling day." Carmel's eyes narrow. Her eyelashes are short and sparse and could do with a coat or two of that volumizing mascara that Rose wears. "Fern, these team-building events are important. Getting the team together in a social environment helps make for better communication in the workplace. Almost as an afterthought, she adds, it's a company-sponsored event, so you don't have to pay.
Again, no question has been posed. I look around and let out a long sigh, attempting to send out a non-verbal message that I am tiring of the conversation and she should speed it up.
Fern, are you planning to put your name down? Carmel says snippily, which frankly is a little annoying as I'm the one who is being put through this pitiful attempt at conversation. But at least she's finally asked an actual question.
No, I say. I don't like bowling.
Now Carmel is red in the face.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, but it is a compulsory event for all staff.
It is?
Yes, it is.
Carmel seems surer of herself now, nodding with each syllable. Yes, it is.
Then why have a sign-up sheet at all?
Well, because...
Carmel drifts off, less certain now. I wait. At lunchtime, I am in the staff room, tapping away at my computer, when Gail appears at my desk. She has what looks like a bit of spinach caught in her teeth, and unusually wide, excited eyes. I'm relieved it's not Carmel. I've made a mental note to avoid Carmel until this bowling function is over, or until her conversation skills improve, whichever comes first.
There's someone here to see you,
Gail says, once I have pointed out the spinach. I frown. The only time anyone comes to see me at work is on my birthday, when Rose comes to take me out to lunch at the sandwich place I like. That is always planned in advance, of course, because I don't like surprises. But today is not my birthday, and I don't have anything planned.
Who is it?
It's the man from the other day. The one who was having trouble with the printer. Gail lowers her voice to say this and waggles her eyebrows up and down. It makes her look quite bizarre.
Where is he? I say, getting up.
Just outside the door, she whispers excitedly.
Sure enough, when I come to the staff room door, Wally is standing there. Alfie is by his side, on the lead.
Hello, I say, then frown at Gail, who is still standing there. She shuffles away sadly.
When I look back at Wally,